I tried to cram as much color in there as I possibly could because it was all fresh and new to me. I'd forgotten how all the bank selecting and anti-piracy stuff worked that I put into it. So I had to spend hours, if not days, breaking my own code.
I'm Kevin Sabitz, and this is an interview episode of Antic, the Atari 8-bit podcast. Bill Hoag was founder of Big Five Software. He was the programmer of the hit 1982 game Miner 2049er and its sequel Bounty Bob Strikes Back. This interview took place on August 31st, 2015. So, I believe you got started game programming on the TRS-80, is that right?
That's true. Yeah, I started programming TRS-80 working at the Radio Shack in Reseda, California.
Hmm. Nice. So you were just a Radio Shack employee?
Yeah, that's true. And I bugged my manager, you know, repeatedly to keep getting more and more computer stuff in. So he was mostly buying it just for me, I think.
Nice. Just toys for you to play with.
Exactly. It got pretty lonely there at night at Radio Shack, you know, because when very few people are coming in for their free batteries.
Right. Yeah, their battery club card. I had one of those.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay, so you taught yourself BASIC on the TRS-80s and kind of give me the story of the pre-Atari story.
Well, yeah, BASIC was the first thing I did. I wrote this game. I don't remember what it did, but I called it Coneheads because, you know, Coneheads on Saturday Night Live was pretty popular at the time. Mm-hmm. And then after that, I bugged my manager to get me to order. Radio Shack had a book all about assembly language programming. So he finally ordered that and got that in the store. And I just started teaching myself machine language and then assembly language programming.
Nice. When did you start publishing games?
Well, I don't remember the year or anything, but it was certainly while I was working at Radio Shack, I believe. Mm-hmm. I was in my second semester at Cal State Northridge when I decided to drop out because, you know, that was going pretty good. Mm-hmm. So I was just sitting in class with, you know, grid paper drawing out little shapes of aliens and stuff like that. And at some point I decided, you know what, maybe I should do this full time.
Nice. So you started publishing, you created Big Five Software, is that correct?
Correct.
So, okay, I've done many interviews with developers, and they all went out there and found publishers, and I'm interested why you created your own software publisher rather than going to an existing one.
Well, I don't know that there were too many big ones around at the time. I mean, I was just doing small-time advertising in the local, or not the local, but, you know, the magazines at the time, mm-hmm. you know, where I would take out small eighth-page ads, and then it worked up years later until we were up to, like, full-page color ads. Mm-hmm. So it just kept growing and growing.
And so you're basically doing mail-order business?
Yeah, all mail-order business. Mm-hmm.
'Cause I assume you couldn't sell in the Radio Shacks.
No. They approached me many, many years later, and we worked out a deal where they sold a few of my games as these, like, game packs. Mm-hmm. So I finally got myself published in a Radio Shack.
So it was just all mail order and people just sending checks to your house, and you were just putting them in baggies? I mean, kind of paint a picture of that for me.
The funny part was going to the local grocery store and loading up a cart full of baggies. I got a lot of strange looks from the cashiers when I would do that. I was like, what are you using these baggies for?
Mm-hmm. Assuming drugs or something.
Yes, definitely.
What do you mean cart full of baggies? How much software were you selling?
Well, you know, a cart full, that might be an exaggeration, but, you know, when you're buying baggies, you want to get all of them at the one time. So.
Sure, sure.
But that was the original packaging when we were doing just single sheets for instructions and baggies. It was, you know, later when we started doing the full color, mm-hmm. you know, stuff where we were shrink wrapping, you know, onto a piece of styrofoam with a cartridge, or I'm sorry, a cassette or a disc inside.
Mm-hmm. And you were just duplicating everything by hand, I assume?
initially, yeah. We just had the Radio Shack, you know, cassette recorders doing that. Yeah. Later, as that grew, you know, we were doing a lot more quantity. I did seek out a local cassette duplicator in North Hollywood, and they were making the cassettes later.
So at what point did you decide to spread out from TRS-80 and move on to other machines?
Well, as the color computers started coming out, I wanted to do something in color. I think I had bought one of the Radio Shack color computers, but I don't recall being too impressed with it. I really liked the Atari because of all the sound and color it had. And that's what led me to the Atari. I think it was mostly the Star Raiders. Is that the name of it, if I remember right? Yeah. I love Star Raiders.
Do you remember the first time you saw an Atari computer?
Yeah, it was a store in Northridge, and they were demoing that Star Raiders game. I went, oh, this is the way to go.
So did you just buy one and take it home and start teaching yourself that assembly language? Or
pretty much, yeah. I mean, I already knew assembly language Z80, but of course now I had to learn a new 6502 language, but, you know, it's the same concept.
So how much time, how much dabbling did you do from this is my first Atari machine to Miner 2049er? Because that's a pretty technically advanced game, seems like.
I don't remember the transition there about how that came about, but I do recall being in awe of all the color that you could do on there. And if you are familiar with the high score screen on Miner 2049er, I tried to cram as much color in there as I possibly could because it was fresh and new to me. I mean, I was using all these displayless interrupts to really overdrive the color and get more than, you know, technically you should have on one screen at any one time.
What can you tell me about the process of creating that game? Where did the idea come from? What did you did? Was this, you know, did it come fully? Was it a process, or did it something that came fully formed as a game idea in your mind?
Well, a lot of the earlier games that I had done were pretty much direct ripoffs, if you want to call it that, which is pretty much the truth of arcade games. And for Miner, actually a game or two earlier on, you know, the TRS-80 Defense Command was, you know, pretty much a new concept that I came up with. But for the first Atari game, I wanted that to be, you know, not like any other arcade game, but yet similar that people would, you know how to play it. So if you think about Miner, it's almost like a combination of like Donkey Kong with the climbing and Pac-Man where you have to go around and eat all the dots. So yeah, it's pretty much a combination of Donkey Kong and Pac-Man. So neither one of those companies could sue me then.
Right. Do you remember how long it took you to program it? I mean, we're talking a month, a year?
I honestly don't remember. It's just so long ago.
Sure. Was it a kind of a given that you would publish it yourself because you already had that process? Or did you at this point, did you think about going to an Atari-specific publisher?
No, never crossed my mind to go to a publisher. I mean, we pretty much had a good mail order thing set up, and we had worked out a lot of relationships with dealers at, you know, small computer stores and even, you know, bigger distributors. So we had all that infrastructure all set up. The decision to go to cartridge was something new to us, you know, because we had to go to a chip manufacturer to get those ROMs produced in quantity because it wasn't going to be cost effective to do EPROMs or something like that at the time.
Right.
So we were a new company to them, so they were pretty hesitant to give us large quantities of ROMs before we paid for them. So we found out pretty quickly that as soon as we would pay for the prior shipment, you know, with the net 30 terms or whatever it was, that suddenly more would show up. So the faster we could pay, the more chips we got.
So why the decision to release Miner on cartridge instead of disk?
I was hoping to prevent piracy as much as possible.
How'd that go?
It went pretty good for a long time. I mean, ultimately, it got busted and put onto disk. But there weren't too many people at the time that had the tools to do things like that.
Right.
Later, when I did Bounty Bob Strikes Back, I mean, that was a new bank-selected chip that the company made available to me. Mm-hmm. And I really think that was really difficult to bust because, you know, you just couldn't flat out copy it to a disk or something like that. I mean, it still was expecting the bank selected architecture on there. Mm-hmm. So you really would have to be a pretty good genius to break that.
Was Miner was kind of a huge hit, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was not only a huge hit on Atari 400 and 800, but International Computer Group, and mostly Barry Friedman, was able to license it to practically every other computer in existence at the time. Mm-hmm. He did a really great job on that.
Nice. And did you code it for the 64 or something, or were you doing that work, or someone else?
No, I only did the Atari 400-800 version of Miner. Mm-hmm. For Bounty Bob Strikes Back, I believe I did it the 64 version for the UK. And I was able to use the code and pretty much just tweak it a little bit to get it to work on the Commodore.
So after Miner came out and was a success, was a sequel pretty much guaranteed to happen? I mean, was it inevitable?
Well, not really, because we had a couple other games that we were trying to develop. The game was really called Scraper Caper, and we did two different versions of that. Neither one of which came out the way Curtis and I, you know, wanted. He was working on the graphics, and I was doing the programming. Mm-hmm. The first version of Scraper Caper we were working on Bonnie Bob was a fireman, and you were going up in a high-rise elevator to save people and things, and you know, from a fire that was going on. Hmm. And I just couldn't get the scrolling to the way I wanted it to, you know, match what people were expecting from Miner. So we kind of threw that out, and we started on another thing that was more of a 3D looking playfield, kind of like Crystal Castles, if you've ever seen that in the,
sure,
the arcade game, the arcade game from Atari. And that, I think, almost came out to be too close to Crystal Castles, and we weren't sure where to take it. Where Bonnie Bob was still a fireman, he was jumping around trying to put out fires on a 3D type playfield. And at some point we just said, you know, what if we just went back and did a straight out sequel, mm-hmm, to Miner 2049er, but just packed in more levels and more 3D looking things and more of everything. Mm-hmm. And that's finally how it came about. Mm-hmm. In fact, it was a secret to most everybody else in my company at the time. We didn't want anybody to know about it. I don't recall why, but when we finally showed them what we'd been working on for the long time, they were quite shocked and surprised.
Nice. I did a quick research. I hadn't heard of Scraper Caper. I did a quick Google here. It looks like you guys came out with ads that in the magazines, and it was kind of heavily promoted, and then ditched in the end.
Yeah, it wasn't just me doing that. Some of the other people that were working with us, you know, to release the other computer versions of Miner, mm-hmm, they had wanted a sequel too. So they were really pressuring me, you know, to come out with something.
Yeah.
In fact, I think the guys that did the Apple version of Miner, they got so tired of waiting for me to do Scraper Caper, they just came out with like a Miner 2049 or 2 that was really not, it wasn't something I sanctioned.
So. So tell me, well, first of all, do you have any of that code? Does Scraper Caper still exist on a floppy somewhere?
No, unfortunately not. I mean, we even made some videotapes on 3/4-inch video for a show, a CES show in Vegas. Uh-huh. And after the company wound down and I, you know, moved to a different house, I just decided, this is never going to be valuable, and I foolishly threw all that stuff out.
You're killing me, Bill.
Yeah. I was so done with that I didn't want to have anything to do with the video games ever again.
Yeah.
So I only saved, you know, a couple boxes of the Atari cartridges and, you know, some of the TRS-80 stuff. So at least I have that.
Yeah. Yeah. So tell me about the name, Miner 2049er. Where'd that come from?
Well, I mean, it's just a play on Miner 49er. Mm-hmm. And we decided that's going to be set in the future, so it'll be Miner 2049er. It's just as simple as that.
All right. That makes sense.
So, I mean, the song that was in there, you know, My Darling Clementine, that's, you know, where that phrase comes from, Miner 49er. So, and I did do the programming of the sound for Miner 2049er, and I truly hated every minute of it because music is not my thing. For Bonnie Bob Strikes Back, another programmer working for us at the time, Jeff Zinn, he did the sound and the music, I should say.
You learned your lesson. You weren't going to go through that again, huh?
Yeah, he was good. He had taken music classes in college, so it was a nice little challenge for him. The interesting thing about the music that he wrote, he was using this multi-part harmony. Mm-hmm. And every once in a while, the sound would go flat. And we could never figure out what was going on with that. Hmm. And we just didn't have the tools at the time, you know, to freeze frame, you know, the audio circuits in there and analyze what was going on. And years later, when I wrote that Miner and Bonnie Bob emulator, I was emulating that so well that the sound started to go flat. And I went, oh my gosh, I can finally debug this. So I finally figured out that the two channels were just not quite in phase, and every once in a while they would become in phase and cancel each other out. And I put a little patch into the emulator that would prevent that from happening. So, you know, the emulator, it never goes flat. So it's slightly better than the original cartridge version.
And the emulated version was released for Windows or Mac or what?
For Windows, yeah. I forgot how many years ago I did that. Now people keep harassing me and telling me it doesn't work on Windows 10 and other new operating systems. And someday I got to get back in there and recompile it and work on it again.
Have you considered or been harassed about doing a version for phones?
Actually, a number of years ago, I actually did license that to a company called Magmic. Mm-hmm. And they came out with a new version they did that had not only the classic version of Miner on there, but like a newer 3D type thing. But I haven't seen any royalties out of that for a number of years now, so we're probably going to have to end that agreement.
Miner was a huge hit, and Bonnie Bob Strikes Back was pretty well received, I think. Why was that it in your Atari, your realm of Atari software? Why was there no more?
I think a lot of people at the time were switching over to Nintendo. Mm-hmm. So it seemed like the Atari market was just collapsing out from under us. And I had made the business mistake of, you know, hiring too many other programmers to try to produce more titles going forward. Mm-hmm. And it just kind of all imploded. Mm. So just ran out of money to keep going.
Yeah. Can you remember other Atari titles that might have been that were planned or started or anything? We talked about a couple before, but
I don't really remember what we had lined up after Bob Strikes Back, to be honest with you.
So what happened next for you?
I ended up working at, I wanted to get out of the game industry. Mm-hmm. So I ended up working at a place that did medical equipment in Camarillo, California for a number of years. And then after that, I moved over to Technicolor. Our film lab was on the Universal lot in, you know, Universal City, mm-hmm. California. And I was there total time for probably over 20 years. And so, I mean, during the 90s and the 2000s, if you were going to the theater, you were a good chance you were seeing movies printed on the equipment that I was working on. Hmm. So we did equipment for all the Technicolor labs, you know, including Montreal, Rome, London, Bangkok, Spain. So I did a lot of traveling, worldwide traveling.
Tell me a story.
Tell you a story. I can tell you that that when I did that emulator that I mentioned earlier, that I'd forgotten how all the bank selecting and anti-piracy stuff worked that I'd put into it. So I had to spend hours, if not days, breaking my own code. It's kind of funny that I never would have thought that in the future, one of the people I would be trying to prevent access to would be me.
Nice. Mm-hmm. To crack your own stuff.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome. Mm-hmm.
But nowadays, you know, I hear from people all the time that keep playing the Bounty Bob and Miner, especially on the 5200. Apparently the Bounty Bob Strikes Back cartridge on 5200 is quite rare. I sold one not too long ago on eBay and was shocked when the bidding ended at $1,700.
Wow.
Yeah, that was nice. Somebody also just recently sent me a YouTube video he had done of his teenage sons trying to play Bounty Bob Strikes Back. Mm-hmm. And I was surprised it was so hard for them. I would have thought kids of today would just find that boring and easy.
Yeah,
but mostly that's Curtis's doing, because he did all those levels, and I recall him sitting there laughing when people would try to play them because it was so hard. He was just sitting there like an evil scientist, wringing his hands. So they're going, "Yes."
His Bounty Bob melts into his hat again and again.
Mm-hmm.
Again. Yeah,
yeah. I built a whole level editor for Curtis on that game.
Really?
So he could sit all day long in his office and all by himself just move pieces around and test play it.
Did you ever consider releasing that to the public? As part of a, I don't know, an add-on kit or something?
I don't know if we considered that at the time. Again, we were trying to do cartridges at the time,
right.
So it was a lot of effort, you know, to put a cartridge together.
Yeah.
And I don't think I would have come out with a disc version because I was so scared of piracy at the time.
I just remember that was one of the fun things about Load Runner is you could make your own levels. And so,
yeah, that maybe something we should have done. So, but
speaking of levels, you had that neat feature where you could cheat, you could jump around, you enter the phone number, and then you could jump to any level.
Yeah, on Miner you enter the phone number, and on Bounty Bob Strikes Back there was different codes that you had to do some convoluted enter a 5-digit code and hold A and start or something like that.
Hmm. I imagine this stuff started, or at least on the first game, started as just a debugging feature. Tell me I'm wrong.
Well, of course, that once you've got the cartridge made, you know, and you want to make sure it works, yeah, that's one way to do it. And we resisted giving out that code initially. But, you know, once people started complaining how hard it was to play that game, and especially Bounty Bob, it's like we just started printing it on a piece of paper and putting it right inside the package.
Oh, wow. So if you could send a message to the Atari 8-bit community that still exists, and you can right now, What would you tell them?
I'd say it's amazing that you're keeping the memory of this system alive. I'm surprised that, first of all, these things are still in existence and haven't all died. That some people still have their 5200s and their 400s and 800s and still enjoy playing them. So, you know, thanks for keeping that slice of the 80s alive for us.
Nice. I think that's what I need. Thank you, Bill.
Okay, you're welcome.
If you enjoyed these interviews and would like to contribute something, I encourage you instead to donate to one of our favorite organizations, the Internet Archive, at archive.org. The Internet Archive is a nonprofit digital library with the stated mission of universal access to all knowledge. They've done incredible things to preserve computer history, including hosting thousands of programs in an in-browser Atari emulator, creating the Wayback Machine, and offering full-page scans of countless Atari computer books and magazines. Make your tax-deductible contribution at archive.org/donate.